Good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and you were just listening to one of my favorite artists, Abigail Spitter McBride, and that was her cut, Let the Way Be Open. Well, tonight I have two wonderful guests for you. The first is Mary Mackey, who's written several novels rich with herstory, specifically novels that include rituals of goddess inspired by her research and the writings of Maria Gimbutas. Dare I say, her work probably would remind us of The Mists of Avalon by one of our favorite all-time authors, Marion Zimmer Bradley. Well, we're going to talk about that and the importance of us being able to rethink and recreate such a tapestry for our contemporary time as we rebirth goddess in the world. We really have to learn how to give ourselves permission to do that, to trust our intuition alongside of solid research. Then, in the second part of the show, we have a returning guest, Vajra Ma, discussing the fourth wave of feminism. Embodied spirituality giving rise to more than a grassroots revolution, a womb roots evolution. That's WOMB, roots evolution. Fun, insightful, and important wisdom that I'm anxious to hear about and share with you, my beloved listeners. But first, do you remember that sound and what it means? Well, if you're a long-time listener, you remember what my What's the Buzz segments. I haven't had one in a while, sometimes because there's just no time when I have two guests, but the climate out there is begging me, steering me in that direction again, to talk about the ideals of the sacred feminine, so needed, and most times going neglected and abused out there in society. So a few important things before my chat with Mary, then Vajra, begins. Well, you may have figured out that I equate Occupation Wall Street with goddess ideals on the rise. People are waking up to the oppression of patriarchy, whether it's the Republicans attempting to thwart voting rights, women's rights, or workers' rights. Goddess is not about the 1%. She's about all her children, not just the people at the top of Reanne Eisler's pyramid of domination. Goddess, she is about partnership, a partnership society. And when we have the 1% owning everything, ruining the lives of everyone else, that's not partnership. So here are a few things for my What's the Buzz segment returned, shall we say. I want to start with this, occupying the USA. As some of you probably remember, I went up to Freedom Plaza on my vacation to be there when the Stop the Machine movement started at Freedom Plaza, and one of the people responsible for actually organizing that was Kevin Zies. And this is a little bit about him and the movement that's going on in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. It goes like this. If anybody can be called the father of the Occupy movement in the USA, it's Kevin Zies, who's worked for years in arriving at what must be done to replace an empire run by psychopaths with democracy, and concluded that our political system is so badly damaged it cannot be repaired by merely running candidates or forming new political parties. When Stop the Machine Steering Committee was formed, I was often asked for input from Kevin. Eventually, the committee decided the occupation would begin on October 6th, the people would occupy Freedom Plaza, and it would be announced in LUV News on the 5th of June. Well, what developed out of all of that is now a national phenomenon, an occupation of the people by the people for the people. The people decide everything in general assemblies, the only real democracy in the land. If you go to our local Occupy group, you will have a voice in the general assembly as big as any other. As usual, LUV News members were wonderful in helping to spread the idea across the land and should take pride in what's been accomplished. I must admit, far more than I believed would happen by this time. Courageous people from the LUV tribe are occupying towns and cities across the land, getting the word out, sending donations, and taking risks to nudge our nation toward real democracy. Now, we are at a point at which we must all hang together. As Ben Franklin put it, or we will be hung separately by an empire that still holds grudges against Cubans for overthrowing its dictator and for the upstart Bolsheviks for overthrowing the Tsar, and still rings Russia with weapons systems and NATO forces. Well, in the following piece, Kevin Zees brings us up to date about the movement. And this is titled, A Warning to the Economic and Political Elites. Listen now. And this is by Kevin Zees, one of the main people of Stop the Machine, Occupying Freedom Plaza out there. Sort of a sister group to Occupy Wall Street. They're just in different places in Washington. Kevin says, the Occupy movement is not only resulting in the occupation of public space, but also in political space. We are already shifting the dialogue, and the movement has just begun. When we started planning the occupation of Freedom Plaza 6 months ago, our goal was to create a space where the ignored voices of the American people could be heard. They are starting to be heard, thanks to occupations all over the country. If it's not clear to the economic and political elites, this is the beginning of an American revolt. Let's see. Before considering occupation, we tried other avenues, elections, lobbying, petitioning, email campaigns, telephone campaigns, marches, rallies, but they had no effect. The country continued to go in the direction of concentrated wealth rather than where supermajorities of Americans really wanted to go. The occupation of Freedom Plaza in downtown D.C. and occupations around the country display our message of anger at the unfairness of the economy, the expanding war quagmires, and the corruption of government that results in the people's urgent necessities being ignored in favor of more wealth for the top 1%. I don't like sleeping in a tent in Freedom Plaza, but we see no other way to get our voices heard. We are occupying Freedom Plaza because Americans have been kept out of the political process. Money rules elections and lobbying, while the 99% are ignored. We occupy Washington, D.C. because it's where big business money combines with campaign laws that corrupt government so it does not respond to the people. Washington, D.C. is corporate occupied territory with 18,000 professional lobbyists, most of who work for business interests pushing the agenda of concentrated wealth. The great wealth care reform triumph of the Obama administration highlighted how out of touch government is with the people. For more than a decade, Americans have simply wanted improved Medicare and for all and removal of the unnecessary insurance industry. Instead, President Obama and the Democratic leadership pushed reform that further entrenched the insurance industry with hundreds of millions of dollars in annual tax subsidies and forcing Americans to purchase flawed insurance. They kept single payer out of the debate because Medicare for all compared with insurance-based health care is less expensive, covers everybody, and improves the quality of health care. The response to the financial crisis was also inadequate. People from Wall Street responsible for the collapse were putting key positions in the administration. Congress was unable to pass real stimulus early in the Obama era. Instead, a weak, partial stimulus was passed that may have slowed the economic collapse but missed the opportunity to turn things around. The financial reform was inadequate as it failed to break up the big banks, bring back Glass-Steagall, or adequately regulate derivatives. Last week, Citibank got off easy with a $285 million fine for the sale of $1 billion in fraudulent mortgage derivatives, but this was only one of many corrupt Citibank deals. The rest will not even be investigated. So once again, obvious and necessary steps were impossible due to corporate power. Occupying space is an opportunity to discuss political taboos. As the war drum against Iran began to beat, Freedom Plaza held an Iran night with Persian food, music, dancing, and discussion. We discussed why war on Iran was wrong, as well as the problems in the U.S., relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel, and we mentioned a reality most had never heard in U.S. media or politics, U.S. empire. While the military still will not say how many bases and outposts it has, the most thorough review estimates there are more than 1,100 around the world, and now a new empire of drones. The British Empire had 37 bases at its peak, and the Romans had 36. The U.S. empire is a secret to most Americans, only discussed as a euphemism. We're policemen of the world. This false description hides the real facts of exploitation and domination. This taboo needs to be broken so Americans can debate whether empire is good for the nation and the world. The Occupy movement is being driven by economic insecurity. Almost all Americans feel that is why we are all part of the 99%. The economic insecurity is not because of lack of resources, but because political elites consistently send money to economic elites through tax breaks and giveaways, resulting in the wealthiest 400 Americans having the wealth of 154 million of us, yet paying 17.4% in federal taxes, while working Americans pay 25 to 30%. The tax structure needs to be restructured so wealth is taxed more than work, purchases of stocks, bonds, and derivatives are taxed, and a truly progressive income tax is put in place. It is this unfairness at a time of economic fear that's driving the Occupy movement. A warning to the elites, occupations are only the beginning. This movement is in its early stage and is going to grow in ways that are hard to imagine right now. We know that decades of the expansion of corporate power will not be undone with one occupation. Plans are being made by some of us to move beyond occupation to the next steps of building a movement that represents all Americans, youth burdened with college loans and lousy jobs, seniors stuck in poverty, retirement with their Social Security, and Medicare threatened. Medicare threatened. The middle class who worked their whole lives and are now part of the long-term unemployed, live in homes with underwater mortgages and fear foreclosure, and of course the poor, homeless, and mentally ill, whose mistreatment has become more obvious as the public space we occupy draws them to us for food and housing. A message for the elites. This is just the beginning. Listen to us now or the price of change will get more expensive for you. What do we seek? We seek an end to corporate rule and shifting power to the people. You can go on the website for Stop the Machine, Create a New World, and read this along with a lot of other things. Some of the media, some people might be listening to say, we don't know what they're all about. Well, you know, it's easy to find out if they just check the internet. You can go to www.october2011.org. That's a part of my What's the Buzz segment tonight. I wanted to share that with you. I certainly am in agreement with all of that because I'm part of the 99%, like I'm sure you are listening out there. And if you stay tuned in with me after Vajra tonight, I'm going to tell you about the top 11 signs you're a Christianist, and I'm going to tell you how to be a fly in the ointment of patriarchy. So remember, if you can't listen at 6 p.m. Pacific when the show airs live on Wednesday nights, you can always catch this show or any other show later from the archives at your convenience, and you can listen via iTunes as well. And if you can't tune in live and have questions, you can always email your questions several days before showtime. And I want to thank you for your input, listeners, and your feedback. Your comments are always welcome. I love when you send me an email saying, can you get this guest on the show? And I try really hard, and most of the time I do. You are gas in my tank. You keep me going, knowing that you care about this show and it means so much to you. Well, you know, that's all I need for me to stay here on the air. So stay tuned. Call in if you like. And if you're listening live, the number is 718-766-4662. And I don't want to keep Mary waiting any longer. Mary, welcome to the show, and I thank you for your patience during my beginning of my What's the Buzz segment.
Oh, it was great to listen to it. I'm glad to be here, and it's extremely relevant because my novels are about the origins of the patriarchal takeover of the goddess cultures. So it could not be more perfect.
Well, you know, it seems that everything always fits in, you know, because everything is all interconnected, and, you're so right. Well, you know, let me just give listeners a little bit of background on you, Mary, and then we're going to jump in and talk about your books that Maria Gimbutas' work so inspired. So listeners, Mary Mackey, she has a PhD in comparative literature and is an emerita professor of English at California State University in Sacramento. So she's the author of 6 collections of poetry, including Sugar Zone, published this fall by Marsh Hawk Press, and numerous novels, including Immersion, the first feminist novel published by a second wave feminist press, The Last Warrior Queen, a novel set in the goddess worshipping cultures of pre-Sumerian Mesopotamia, and The Year the Horses Came, The Horses at the Gate, and The Fires of Spring, based on the work of Maria Gimbutas and set in old Europe before and during the invasion of patriarchal nomads. One of the founders of the Feminist Writers Guild, along with Susan Griffin, Adrian Rich, and Valerie Miner, as well as one of the founders of the American Studies Program, Women's Studies Program, sorry about that, at California State University in Sacramento. Mary Mackey is included in the Pioneer Feminist Project House and the Sophia Smith Collection at Smith College, and from 89 to 92, she served as chair of the West Coast branch of Penn. She's a fellow of the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. She's lectured at Harvard and the Smithsonian and has contributed to such diverse publications as the Chiron Review, Salon, New Age Journal, the American Book Review, Yellow Silk, and Ms. Magazine. Her work has received commendations from the California Arts Council as well as the Women's Spirituality Program of California Institute of Integral Studies, which in 2004 honored her with a Foremother of Women's Spirituality Award. Her greatest regret is that, short of the invention of a workable time machine, she cannot live in the goddess-worshipping cultures of old Europe. And we want to make mention, The Year the Horses Came has just become available in ebook format on Amazon Kindle. The Horses at the Gate and The Fires of Spring will be available as Kindle ebooks within the next 2 weeks. And by the end of 2011, all of Mary's novels and collections of poetry will be available in all ebook formats. And we're going to mention her websites later, but let me just give you one right now, her homepage. And it's her name, Mary Mackey, MaryMackey.com. So, Mary, you were telling me before the show started you can get that book rather inexpensively, can't you?
Right, and I'm so happy about this because I've wanted these goddess books to be available to everybody at very, very inexpensive rates. I want them to sell to the 99%, you know. So it used to be you had to pay $20 for them, which I had no control over, and now I've been able to set the price on Kindle at $2.99. So I'm very happy to be able to put them all out there for anybody, you know, can take them. You could take them on a pilgrimage on your, you know, and they won't just be on Kindle, they'll be on all ebook formats. So it's wonderful to have them there, affordable for everybody.
Well, you know, Mary, I think it's really important what you're doing because, you know, people might say, oh, it's just a novel of fiction. Well, you know what? It's really so much more than that because not only are you using, you know, Gimbutas research to enrich the novel, but I think it's so important for women today to have some sort of inspiration as we try to rebirth goddess in our world. You know,
yeah, I mean, go ahead, excuse me.
Well, I remember when I read Marion Zimmer Bradley's book, you know, The Mists of Avalon. You know, that book I read 2 decades ago, and I still count it as one of my favorite books, you know, because it was so potent. And when we read these sorts of books, I think it empowers us as women. It helps us remember a time past. I'm sure you can probably speak to it better than I can because you had to put this all together.
Yeah, Marion Zimmer Bradley liked my work. She gave me a quote for it, you know, because she liked it. And I, you know, Mists of Avalon is just wonderful. But our books have a lot in common in that we look at the goddess cultures and the rituals. And I also think the books that I've written about old Europe based on Maria Gimbutas' works give us a vision of a world where we had equality between the sexes, where we had goddess rituals and peace and a look at the earth as a living thing versus a piece of property. And what I look in my books is how these cultures react to patriarchal nomads who come in and see the earth as real estate and enslave women and children. And, you know, but in the first book, In the Year the Horses Came, you see these beautiful, diverse cultures all over Europe at about 4,300 BCE. And this is based a lot on the archaeological research of Maria Gimbutas. Maria helped me with these books, and I talked to her about them and got advice from her. And she said they were extremely good recreations, but she also asked me to imagine the rituals, the prayers, the songs, and that's something I've done all through these books. So that these books contain the goddess cultures, I hope, sort of raising up the bones and making them speak and drum and bringing the flowering of it to the readers, and that was my aim.
Well, you know, we hear all the time, you know, at least in some of the circles, you know, I float around in, oh, you know, we have to sort of prove to the mainstream out there there were matriarchies, or we have to prove, you know, that there were, you know, goddess societies. Well, you know, I'm not sure, you know, I believe that we have to prove these things happened in the past to have a better world today and actually embrace these sorts of more nurturing ideals. But If you do think that way, this I think helps us imagine something other than we see today, because people go, well, this is all there's ever been. It can't be any other way. But yes, it can.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that most of the towns in Europe, they didn't have organized warfare. They weren't fortified. They didn't have genocide. They didn't have all of these things. I'm not saying people didn't occasionally get angry. And, you know, even murder was probably committed from time to time. But this great organized perpetual warfare and this squabbling over land and property, you know, and this treating of the earth as if it's not a living being, it's really something that's the new thing. The old religion of the human race was that the earth was a living being, a goddess. And, you know, when I was writing these books, I tried to imagine that everywhere I walked, I was walking on the body of the mother goddess. And it really profoundly, spiritually changed my life to do that.
Well, and I think for women or men who maybe want or looking, I mean, I get people all the time that say, you know, Karen, how can I connect to goddess?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and aside from, you know, maybe do something at your personal altar or going to a ritual, you know, with people that, you know, you know do good ritual, reading a book like this, I bet, would also be a way to sort of plug in, don't you think?
Yeah, what I think it allows you to do, and what I wanted to write it so my readers could do, these three books, is to let you live in that world, completely imaginatively live in that world and get to know the people as people, so that it's not just dry potsherds and mounds of earth and things, but these are living people living their lives in a completely, you know, a different view. I mean, you know, that view remains as part of Western European culture, but it was overcome in some ways, and I think it's rising to the fore again. I think we're coming back to it, and I wanted people to be able to, you know, take a vacation there. I mean, it's so healing to be able to do that.
Well, this would really be a gift for yourself. I mean, the holidays are coming. People are going to maybe have some days off for Thanksgiving, some days off for Christmas. You know, maybe they can grab one of your books and treat themselves, you know, to an immersion, you know, into a time, maybe we're romantic about this. You know, maybe we're romanticizing that time. I'm sure life wasn't easy, but the values, we think, were so different that it may be offset not having technology and comfort and, you know, a grocery store on the corner, you think?
Well, you know, it was amazingly, they had weaving, they had pottery. These people aren't living in caves. I mean, this isn't Clan of the Cave Bear. They had some cities in northern Romania, near what's now Moldova, actually, that had 20,000 people in them, made in great goddess-like spirals. I mean, there was much more beauty and culture there than I had ever imagined when I started doing this. So, yeah, and there was also peace, and there was, and you know, as whether or not this is real, of course my novels are fiction, although based very on research, but I think we have to have these visions to create a better world. We need the vision to move forward. I mean, we only do what we can dream, and this allows us to dream a world that worked in a very different way, in a very earth-supportive, woman-supportive, and man-supportive way.
Perfectly put. So now these books are called the Earth Song Trilogy, right?
Yeah, but that you find them by the title or by my name. They're The Year the Horses Came, The Horses at the Gate, and The Fires of Spring. And they're all
now,
in
what
a trilogy.
Do the horses signify? Were horse? You know,
very good question. The horses had died out of Europe in the last ice age. And so the nomads who invaded, and there are lots of evidence of this archaeologically, who invaded from the steppes of Russia, came in on horses, which was pretty much like an atomic bomb or a jet plane. This is not, by the way, the fault of the horses. I like horses a lot. But they were able to, you know, if you live next to your neighbors and you go over and burn their village, they'll come burn your village. I mean, you live near your neighbors. With the horses, you could come in and raid and be 50 miles away before anybody could get it together to go after you. So the image of the man on horseback being the patriarchal ruler comes into Europe at this time when horses are reintroduced. And so the novel, The Year the Horses Came, starts with a whole society that's never seen organized war or horses. And the first time they see the horses, they think the men and horses are the same being. They can't believe the difference. They don't even see there's a difference.
Right. Yeah, because I understand what you're saying. I mean, it's making me think about when the Aztecs or the Mayans saw the
exactly.
ships, you know, coming across the water toward them. You know, they had never seen such a thing before.
And they couldn't
yeah, it just wasn't in their repertoire.
Right, and
say.
Also, you know, I believe that the patriarchal nomads who came in on horseback and caused this, you know, this started actually organized warfare in Europe and looted these goddess cultures were this in some ways the, you know, they were the great 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 grandfathers of the same men who came in on horseback in the New World and pretty much eliminated many of the Native Americans.
And so now we're, you know, forgive me, I'm really horrible with timelines. Would these be, so these riders on horseback, what part of the globe would you say they are coming from, and what part of the world in your books are they, you know, destroying?
Okay, they are coming from basically the Great Plains, the Ukraine, and those great, great plains that lie between China and Europe, which I call in the book the Sea of Grass, the steppes, basically. And there's, you know, they were there for thousands of years.
The Attila the Hun, sort of.
Right, only way before Attila, but there have been waves of these. In my books, they never get farther than, around the Black Sea, northern Romania. But it takes them 2,000 years. They don't come as one army, of course. They come as a series of invasions. By 2,000 years, they've pretty much overrun all of Europe, and except for Crete, and have even gotten into Ireland. So it takes about 2,000 years for this conquest to happen. But the goddess cultures are preserved all over the place despite these invasions in places like Delphi and Crete and in the caves of Ireland and all over. So it's a story that has some happiness in it, but I don't go all the way through there. I only go to the point where they just start arriving.
Okay. And while we're going to mostly focus on this, I want to just highlight these others too. The Last Warrior Queen, that one's set in pre-Sumerian Mesopotamia. How is that one different other than the setting? Or are you also using, archaeology and actual research?
I'm using archaeology and actual research. And that book was written way long ago in the mid-70s, inspired by Merlin Stone's When God Was a Woman. And I read When God Was a Woman, and I said, of course, of course, this had to be true. And so, everybody has, understands this now, but to me this was like a revelation. And so I started doing research on ancient Sumeria and found all these relics of goddess rituals in ancient Sumeria. And so I wrote my first novel, The Last Warrior Queen, about the goddess cultures that were overcome in ancient Sumeria. And at the time, nobody knew what to do with it. I had quotes on the book from Marge Piercy and Tilly Olson, and they put it in science fiction. There was not even a women's section of this, so it was actually a piece of women's visionary fiction far, far before its time. It always seems to be my curse that I'm writing things long before people understand what I'm doing, but in some ways it's also
a
blessing.
Well, you're a woman ahead of her time.
Really?
What I call that? I call that having the pink-handled machete, because so many of us are out there blazing that trail, whacking through the weeds with that pink-handled machete, so that, we can show a new idea, a new direction. You're one of those ladies.
I love that image, and that's particularly relevant because my first novel, which was written in the very late 60s, Immersion, which was the one published by Shameless Hussy Press, was arguably the first eco-feminist novel written, but at the time you can imagine people looking at it and saying, what is a woman doing writing a novel, much less, what is this about? People didn't even know how to spell the word ecology. They were still spelling it with a K.
So what is Immersion about?
Immersion is about a woman in the rainforests of Costa Rica watching her her biologist husband destroying species after species in the forest and dealing with the problems in the marriage and also the problems this creates among the people who are living in the forest.
Wow. Good stuff, Mary. Really interesting, interesting stuff. Let's talk a little bit about how did you actually come to be inspired to write these books?
Well, as I said, I had already written When God Was, The Last Warrior Queen, inspired by When God Was a Woman. I had also been involved and lived in Berkeley and been involved in people who were creating the Mother Peace Tarot. I had been involved in moon goddess rituals. And then I got a call from HarperCollins in San Francisco, and they said, we've got this book by Maria Gimbutas here, The Civilization of the Goddess, And we think it would make a great novel. Are you interested? Because we've seen you've written this other novel. They finally sort of recognized what was going on. And I said, I didn't know about it at the time. And I looked at it and I said, oh, yes. So they gave it to me in manuscript. And I then started creating the novels from that in the language of the goddess. And with these wonderful illustrations, and Maria's work is so thorough and so beautifully done that it really was a novelist's dream. I had to do other research on weather and animals and crops and all sorts of other things, but this was a wonderful basis for my work, and she was so helpful to me.
Well, and you know, and I'm sitting here thinking, oh, what a gift it would be to have these books made into films.
You know, I've always felt that, and I have, you know, I've tried over and over to see if I could do it, and I'm just hoping someday some woman filmmaker, whether I'm still around or not, I don't care, actually, it can be any filmmaker, will see what great films these would make. Because they're all filmed outdoors. They wouldn't even, you know, have huge sets to build.
Well, you know, the guy who did Avatar, Cameron, James
mm-hmm.
Cameron.
Yes.
You know what, I think he's a closet goddess guy, you know.
Avatar was the most beautiful movie. I mean, just the forest and the mother tree and everything were just very touching. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I mean, that was like goddess church. You know, I wish there was a way you could send him your novels and maybe pique his interest.
I'm afraid Mr. Cameron is getting many people's novels, but, you know, it's a good idea.
You never know.
Yeah.
If it's meant to be, maybe it'll happen.
Well, I write film scripts, and I have a script writing partner, and she's been trying to work on this, so we may get it together. You never know.
Oh, well, that would be so incredible. Well, so how did you create the rituals?
Well, I created the rituals in two ways. The first way is the one you just imagined, the easiest, which was that I looked at the ritual objects and I looked at the possible uses of them, I created the rituals using the objects. But at the same time, I tried to, you know, I put myself sort of in an imaginative, creative, almost semi-trance state, and I tried to imagine what were the things that, you know, that didn't survive in the earth. Like, what were the songs like, the prayers like, what did they do? And I created, you know, like, there's one ritual where people use sand paintings, and as they do the paintings, they go into a kind of trance, and they're able to diagnose people who are ill. And, you know, the Hopi do sand paintings, and so do the Tibetans. And I thought, well, on both sides, here they are on both sides of the world doing this. I bet this is a very, very old ritual. So I took the liberty of importing that. The fact that you find pottery, weaving, and baking in the temples in old Europe, I decided that all of these things were ritual. So there's rituals that prayers people say when they make pots and when they bake and when they weave. And there's a weaving ritual that forms a very important part of the second novel, The Horses at the Gate.
Well, and I would imagine, here's my imagination running wild, and I haven't read the books yet, but I do look forward to reading them when I have time and can just immerse myself in them and enjoy them. You know, I would imagine, you know, there are rituals around sexuality or childbirth.
Very much. And it's a culture in which sexuality is not only egalitarian, but it's a joy, it's a gift of the goddess. And I even came up with 6 commandments to sort of replace the 10 commandments. Would you like to hear them?
Sure, yeah.
So here are the 6 commandments of the Divine Sisters. Live together in love and harmony, cherish children, honor women, respect old people. Remember that the earth and everything on it is part of the living body of your Divine Mother. Enjoy yourselves, for your joy is pleasing to her. And,
I like that.
Yeah. And so there are rituals that involve sex and eroticism that are joyful. It's not like guilty and sinful and involving, you know, ownership in a slave-like way. It's consensual and happy.
Right, right. Well, you know, I remember when I read The Red Tent, and I've tried to get that author on the show, but I can't. I can't entice her on because she said, I believe she said, and I might have this wrong, my memory might be a little bit hazy, I think she said that she imagined some of the rituals in the book as if that was a bad thing, you know, but I think she felt because maybe she had imagined them and they weren't necessarily based on something in some dusty tome somewhere that she could point to, maybe it made her uncomfortable that there wasn't You know, she couldn't prove that they were done, but yet I remember there was one ritual in there when a woman, a young girl, was going to be married, and one of the, I believe the and you may have read this, but the women actually gathered around her in the red tent, and they broke her hymen for her, you know, in a sacred way, you mm-hmm. know, so that it didn't have to be some sort of brutal, painful, you know, kind of ordeal, you know. Instead, it was, you know, it was done with love and care, and it became part of the women's rituals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I can, you know, my imagination runs wild with the things that we could, you know, I'm not saying we could reestablish that necessarily in our culture, but when you look at what we, the opposite of what we have, female genital mutilation, you know, I mean, women do need to reestablish rituals of all sorts, I think, in order just to, I think, help bolster our empowerment, our own herstory.
Well, yeah, and one of the things in my novels that I imagine for the women as a ritual is that no one has sex with a woman unless she consents. It's a little tap on the thigh. That's the consent. You can have all sorts of cuddling and canoodling and stuff, but there's no actual sex doesn't happen. Penetration doesn't happen. So people have lots of sex that we might not even call sex, starting at whatever age they feel like it. And then at mm-hmm. some point they decide if they, you know, want to have. But the women are always the ones who make that decision.
Yeah.
So that's one small ritual they have. But there are a lot of others. That are, but it's not just a book about ritual and recreation. It's also a book I've tried to make the people, you know, there's love and there's romance and there's excitement. There's a real world going on here, because I think that's the kind of world people want to live in. And for a little while when they read novels, they don't just want to read a technical book. So
exactly. Well, you also had some ideas about what it was like to be a priestess in old Europe.
Yeah, in old Europe, in my novels, the priestesses, the towns are governed by priestesses and consuls of priestesses, but they're governed in a very democratic, consensual fashion, much like Occupy Wall Street, as a matter of fact, where things are done in large meetings of the community, and then there is the priestesses sort of have them. They're not a priesthood that bosses everybody around. They're kind of the town council that carries things out, with a priestess leading them, and they often ask for inspiration from the goddess. They often ask for, you know, ethical decisions. They ask, you know, they make spiritual decisions based on the idea of equality and love and compassion.
Well, let me just tell you something totally separate from this. My switchboard is acting a little bit hinky, and I doubt that anything weird is going to happen, but if by any chance you and I get disconnected, I will call back in and you just call back in, okay?
Okay, sounds
just
good.
A heads up. But, you know, going back to this, you know, I was thinking about when you said, you know, how the community would get along. We all know there was a reason Phyllis Chesler wrote her book, Women's Inhumanity to Women.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow I think patriarchy has a lot to do with women's inhumanity to women. Do you imagine, I mean, of course, nothing's ever, a utopia, but can you imagine that things might have been better between women in these days?
Well, I think in general, personal relationships between women and men and women are better when you don't have women being held as property, which they were for, you know, thousands of years. When women aren't economically dependent on survival, on husbands, when husbands don't have several wives, when women aren't in competition with one another, women have a kind of independence and a dignity, and they're their own person. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot less conflict. And, you know, one of the things, the problems that young women have had in our society is that their mothers have to teach them about what's, you know, the oppression in the society. And in this society, being a woman was a wonderful thing that was exalted. And so I think that also makes it less less competition and less nastiness all over in every aspect of the society.
Once again, it is
a utopia, but I do think it's much, much more peaceful.
So aside from, you know, helping govern the community, so to speak, were you able to, like, reimagine maybe the magical or shamanistic sort of rituals or
yes.
roles of the
There are many shamanistic rituals. There's one at the early beginning where the main character, whose name is Marat, who's just had her 14th coming of age, you know, 14th birthday coming of age ceremony, her mother takes her and gives her, you know, a steam bath, which is one of these things, and they take what's called the bread of darkness, which is a kind of, you know, we don't know quite what it is, and they together share a vision, and they're able to see into the future, and they see the beast men, the men on horses, coming. And so the impulse of the first novel is that Marat's mother, who can't travel herself, sends Marat all the way across old Europe to warn the people of the East. Because they're in Brittany, and they go all, and Marat goes all the way across Europe. And of course, as she goes across Europe, she sees all these diverse goddess cultures. And then when she gets to the Black Sea coast, she warns the people that the beast men are coming. And this comes from a vision in a very strong ritual. There are other rituals. There's one ritual where Marat is, in the second book, trained by the Imsha, who's a, you know, could be male or female. She's a black priestess or priest from Africa, who's come to old Europe to teach people the secrets of African spirituality. And she has Marat weave her own hair into a net that allows her to catch time and have a vision, once again, of the very, very far future, and to walk into it, shrink very small and walk into it through the net. So there are these many beautiful visions. There's a lot of songs. Each chapter has a poem song before it that guides Marat. That's a ritual poem.
When you were doing this, did you sort of get the idea that we have probably lost so much ancient knowledge? I mean, like, I'm hearing you talk about, you know, them being able to see the future and stuff like that, but I'm thinking about there's this little French film that you can get over the internet. And you have to read the English subtitles. I think it's called the Beautiful Green, Beauvert, or something like that. And it talks about the future. And people from the future are actually looking back at us in the now. And they have the ability to time travel. They all have these extraordinary abilities, you know, because their lives are different. You know, they're not living like we live today. You know, they can develop these abilities and things that we can't even imagine a human being might be able to do. And I always think that maybe it was like that in ancient times, and we've lost the knowledge that we could do so much more.
Well, you know, I don't think, of course, and I wish we could, I don't think we'll ever know for sure one way or the other, but I can tell you that fiction, one thing fiction does is fiction becomes a time machine that takes those of us who are in the future here back to that past. So at least in one way, at least through the imagination, we can travel in time and we can travel back. I'm sure a lot of ritual knowledge has been lost. There's no question that in all parts of the world, the knowledges of indigenous people and the spiritual knowledge, which is very possible, powerful, a great deal of it has been lost. But I'm thankful for what we have left. I really am.
Yeah. Well, you know, you think about the Library of Alexandria, you know, disappearing, and who knows what other bastions of knowledge, you know, possibly disappeared over time from fire or flood or whatever. And, you know, I just can't help but think we're just, you know, tapped into a minute part of our abilities.
Well, you know, when the Spanish came into Mexico, they burned most of the Mayan books, and when they came into Peru, they destroyed these memory strings, these knotted strings that told the whole history of the Incas. So there's been some intentional destruction. And then, of course, there's the loss of cultures that weren't written down, and the lineage wasn't preserved. So we can't even, there's unimaginable amounts of things that have been lost.
Yeah, and I mean, it probably goes without saying, but let's punctuate it anyway, that, you know, these cultures who obliterated these, you know, maybe advanced and knowledgeable societies of the past, you know, did so to take their power away.
Oh, yes, indeed, of course.
You know, so... All right. So now, so where do you start? With which ones of the books? Is it The Horses at the Gate? Is
no,
the
Year
one?
The Horses Came. You can sort of see it this way. First the horses come, then they come up to the gates, and then things get on fire. So that's
okay.
A simple way. The Year the Horses Came is the first year the horses appear, the nomads appear in Europe. The Horses at the Gate, there's struggle, and then The Fires of Spring is the second generation when the world is really changing.
Okay, okay. Now, in The Horses at the Gate, I know you told me one of the characters is a transgender priestess from Africa.
Yes.
Why did you put him, her, in the book as a teacher of goddess?
I put him, her, in the book of the teacher of goddess because I really believe that the religion of the earth as a living being, which is how I really see goddess worship, is the old religion of the human race. And that coming out of Africa, I believe it came out of Africa and spread with the emergence of human Homo sapiens out of Africa. I mean, I think it is the very first and primary religion. And also, there are so many instances in Europe of the dark goddesses in all sorts of places that I think this must be a heavy African influence. The transgender part is that there are a lot of religions that feel that people who are transgendered have a more comprehensive spiritual contact. There was, you know, Tiresias in the Greek plays was both male and female. And they asked him which was better, and he said both had their advantages, actually. And then, you know, in the Brazilian religion of Candomblé, there are gods that are female half the year and male the other half of the year, 6 months,
oh.
6 months. And in that religion, in order, if you're a woman, you can be one of the priestesses of the religion. But if to be a priest of the religion as a man, you have to be either transgendered or gay because you have to have this feminine goddess part of you in it.
Mm-hmm.
This is
mm-hmm.
a religion. Candomblé is a Brazilian religion with something like, I don't know, you know, 2.5 million followers, maybe more than that. So these, and I've spent a lot of time in Brazil, so these also added to my idea that someone who was transgendered sees both halves of the world differently
mm-hmm.
from a viewpoint that someone who's not can't. So that was the African transgendered part for it.
Well, actually, you know, that's really interesting that you said that because, you know, I don't go around advertising it, but I've always sort of thought that the people who were transgendered were actually really sort of closer to the source in a sense, you know, because we're always talking about, oh, if you're female, you have to be able to embrace your male. If you're male, you have to be able to embrace your female. And that brings wholeness and balance. So instead of these people being, you know, demonized or denigrated, you know, they may be closer to the source themselves, you know, because they embody both.
Well, you know, what we do know very specifically is that many peoples around the world have respected people who not only are transgendered, but people who have epilepsy, people who have certain kinds of visions as people who are getting sacred information. And instead of seeing it necessarily as an illness, they see it as a talent, an advantage, a conduit. And there are whole temples built to these people in Greece. And, you know, I mean, this is not a fantasy. This is an actual historical fact. So.
Okay. Well, when you were writing this, I mean, you were, I know how long it takes to write a book, and here you were having to, you know, dig deep and let that veil lower and, you know, connect with that other side of yourself to come up with these sacred rituals. Did it have an impact on your own spiritual life?
It really did, and I think I mentioned this before, but what it really made me conscious of was how alive the earth is in all its forms and how much we have in common with animals and they have with us in terms of our emotions and our place on this planet. And also it made me see the crazy destruction we are wreaking on the goddess earth, on the earth herself, that we are, you know, paving it over and chopping down the trees. And we have to, I believe that in order to survive as a species, we need to start seeing the earth as a living being, not, you know, greater than us in unimaginable ways, but still that, in or, you know, that we live on as if we were living in the arms of a mother. And I think
right.
if we get that vision, which is the vision I got as I wrote these books, I think that's the vision that will save us. I think
yeah.
more than any kind of information, we need this spiritual understanding that the earth is alive.
Yeah, yeah. Instead of this arrogance that, you know, she's there for the rape and the plunder.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, and almost, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's a huge subject, and let's not go there because, you know, that could be a whole other show. But are there present-day priestesses that are used in any of the rituals you created?
Well, yeah, several groups have invited me and have done rituals with me and coming from these novels. But there's a temple in Sweden. I'm sorry, I don't have the name of it right here. And there's a woman who has written me about this goddess temple in Sweden. She is blind, and she read my books, I think, in Braille, because I've always donated my books to, you know, books for the blind. And she decided she was inspired to become a priestess in this goddess temple and is bringing the rituals into the temple. And also at the same time, Maria Gimbutas's work herself has inspired many, many goddess rituals. So I'm moving in the same, you know, in a parallel with Maria's work.
So yeah. So there is a goddess temple in Sweden?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't even know.
Yeah.
And I thought I knew where all of them were. I knew about the one in England, obviously, you know, in Glastonbury, but I didn't know about the one
in
Sweden.
And there are, you know, movements to create goddess temples in the United States. Christina Biaggi, who's a wonderful artist, has been working on getting a goddess temple somewhere in New York for quite a while, and I'm hoping that will happen. I think
we need them in every neighborhood.
Well, yeah, if we don't have a temple, you don't really need a building because the temple is it's the sky and the air and the trees. I mean, you really don't need anything but to understand that the living earth under your feet is alive, and I think that is the temple.
Right, right. Well, do you think it's important to recreate these rituals in a way that's acceptable, accessible to the general public? I mean, how do we make this so that it's not scary to people in the Abrahamic religions, for instance?
Well, you know, I am not so concerned that people perform rituals of worship as that they feel the magic and holiness of the earth. And I think that's perfectly compatible with certain aspects of the Abrahamic religions. There's that wonderful line that Christ has his eyes on the sparrows, you know. There are ways of seeing the earth as seeing ourselves as the caretakers of the earth, of the garden, that fit wide ranges of present religious worship. And I think this idea of the earth as living and the goddess earth really transcends simple ritual. I think it's much bigger. So I think that the way it becomes not scary is to look. You can find the origins and the existence of this in almost every of the Abrahamic religions. And I think to bring that part out, and particularly encourage the women of the religion to see that part, can help it not be frightening or alienating.
Well, you know what, let me ask you, Vic, and obviously they can go get your book, but, you know, I have a lot of listeners in red states around the country who can't talk to anyone about this stuff, and they look at the show as sort of a lifeline. If they don't have a community to learn from and share with, do you have any tips for them on how they can do this themselves?
Yeah, I do. First of all, we have if they're not entirely alone, I think they could get together with groups of like-minded women. And of course, if they're entirely isolated and they feel they can't even mention this to anybody, there are also online groups of people who come together in solidarity. But at the same time, I think that they can take a walk in the woods and stand there and feel the earth and thank the earth for existing and feel the strong beauty of the power of living things around them. And I think that in itself will be very healing and refreshing and help them not feel alone, because you're just never alone. You're on the body of the Mother Earth. You are actually never alone. That's one of the things that I learned when I was writing the novels as I walked on the living earth. You are never alone. She's always there.
And it sounds oversimplified, but, you know, there's a lot to be said for taking some time every night to just go watch the phases of the moon, mm-hmm. you know, or to be out in nature by a brook and, you know, in the lush grass under a beautiful tree. You know, there's you know, it's hard to language.
Yeah, I mean, that's not laziness. That is coming in touch with the ultimate reality right there. And, I mean, I personally meditate every day, and I have for, 30 years, every single morning. And that's my quiet time, and that really keeps me in touch.
Okay. Well, now you think there's a vital message that the goddess-worshipping cultures of old Europe have for us. I suspect I sort of know what they are, but just in case we haven't really punctuated that, do you want to share that with listeners?
Yeah, I think the greatest message is that things don't have to be like they are now. I think that's the greatest message, that this is not the doom of the human race, perpetual warfare, and the oppression of women and men by the rich to the poor. I think that there has been a time, a very long period in human history, where things were different. So I think that if nothing else, it says to us there are alternatives here. The other thing is, the thing, and I know I've said this several times, but I'll just say it again, is the message of the earth is a living being. Because once you see that you're tearing apart a living being, I think it changes your whole attitude toward digging copper out of the earth and throwing pollution into the ocean. That you're,
absolutely,
you know, you're tearing apart your mother, really, when you're doing
right.
That.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, if you don't care that, you know, even if you don't care that you're poisoning the air you're breathing and the water you have to drink, you know, it's murder.
Well, also, it'll come back. You know, it'll poison ultimately the lives of your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren, because you're destroying, you're killing something that sustains you. You're killing the major thing that sustains you. So I think those two things, that the earth is living and that there are alternatives, alternatives ways of structuring societies, are the two greatest gifts that we get from the goddess cultures.
Okay. Well, now let's make sure we tell listeners again how to get hold of these novels, because I think after this discussion, you're probably going to have people, you know, clamoring. So if you would, please explain how we get these.
The of course, you could order them from your local independent bookstore. This is a good thing. If that is not an option for you, the easiest thing to do at the moment is to go online, and right now they're only on Amazon. Very soon they'll be everywhere for e-readers. You go to Amazon.com, you search Mary Mackey, and the first book you want to search for is The Year the Horses Came, and that's M-A-C-K-E-Y, Mackey. The Year the Horses Came, and that's the first book in the series, and that's the one that's available for $2.99 on Kindle. That just happened 4 hours ago, 4 or 5 hours ago, that it went up. And you know, the other books are available in used versions, some of them fairly modestly, but they'll all be on Kindle pretty soon. So if you don't have an e-reader, you can still get them in used or reprint versions online too.
Okay, yeah, I'm old-fashioned. I like to lay in the bathtub with bubbles with a book.
Yeah, so do I. And if they go to my website, marymackey.com, they'll find all my books listed and information about them. So that might be an easy way, if you forget, just to go to marymackey.com.
Yeah, because I think, you know, I'd want The Last Warrior Queen, too, and I definitely would want to read Immersion. I want to read all of them, Mary.
Well, yeah, The Last Warrior Queen. The Authors Guild reprinted The Last Warrior Queen, The Year the Horses Came, The Horses at the Gate, and The Fires of Spring in hardback copy about 5 years ago. So they are all available in hard copy.
Now, you have a Facebook page too, right?
I do. I have a Facebook page.
So listeners could contact you on Facebook?
Right. It's a Facebook authors page, and you don't have to belong to Facebook to look at the Facebook authors page. So also, if they want to find out more information about me, somebody, I have no idea who, put up a very good Wikipedia page about me that's very well researched, and that gives links to all sorts of other things.
Oh, that's awesome. What a nice gift the day
you
found that,
yes, it was
that,
a wonderful
huh?
gift. I don't know who did it. I suppose somebody who liked the books. I have no idea. You know, I mean, I wouldn't know how to do a Wikipedia page if you paid me. So I was just very gratified to see that the page got put up. So that was lovely.
Well, Mary, thank you so much. I think you have given us a lot of women and men so much. I mean, this is really important. And I know we've talked a lot about a lot of things, but, you know, we're going to have to end now, unfortunately. But is there anything we haven't covered that you feel like maybe you want to just make sure you say briefly?
No, except, you know, just bring the joy of the natural world into your life. It'll change it. I guess that's the only thing I want to say.
Okay. Well, Mary Mackey, that's M-A-C-K-E-Y. You can find her on the Internet just by her name. Mary, thank you so much for being
Karen,
on the show.
Thank you,
I really appreciate
all your listeners.
It. All right.
Take care.
Good evening and good night. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, you're hearing it again. It's part two of my What's the Buzz segment we're going to do real quick before I invite Vajra on the show. I promised you at the opening I was going to tell you the top 11 signs you're a Christianess. And I want to thank one of my listeners for sending this in. Thank Jeanette. Number one, well, actually, it's from 11 down to one. Number 11, you believe in a book that was written 70 years after your Messiah died by men who never met him. Ever play telephone? But you continuously deny modern science books. Number 10, you vigorously deny the existence of thousands of gods claimed by other religions but feel outraged when someone denies the existence of yours. Number 9, you feel insulted and dehumanized when scientists say that people evolved from other life forms, but you have no problem with the biblical claim that we were created from dirt. Number 8, you laugh at polytheists, but you have no problem believing in a triune God or a trinity. Number 7, your face turns purple when you hear of the atrocities attributed to Allah, but you don't flinch when hearing about how God or Jehovah slaughtered all the babies of Egypt in Exodus and ordered the elimination of entire ethnic groups in Joshua, including women, children, and trees. 6, you laugh at Hindu beliefs that defy humans and Greek claims about God sleeping with women, but you have no problem believing that the Holy Spirit impregnated Mary, who then gave birth to a man God who got killed, came back to life, and then ascended into the sky. Number 5, you are willing to spend your life looking for little loopholes in the scientifically established age of Earth, a few billion years, but you find nothing wrong with believing dates recorded by Bronze Age tribesmen sitting in their tents and guessing that Earth is a few generations old. Number 4, you believe that the entire population of this planet, with the exception of those who share your beliefs, though excluding those of all rival sects, will spend eternity in an infinite hell of suffering, and you consider your religion the most tolerant and loving. Number 3, while modern science, history, geology, biology, and physics have failed to convince you otherwise, some idiot rolling around on the floor speaking in tongues may be all the evidence you need to prove Christianity. Number 2, you define 0.01% as a high success rate when it comes to answered prayers. You consider that to be evidence that prayer works, and you think that the remaining 99.99% failure was simply the will of God. And finally, number 1, of the top 11 signs you're a Christianess, you actually know a lot less than many atheists and agnostics do about the Bible, Christianity, and church history, but still call yourself a Christian. Well, Jeanette, thank you for sending that in. That did give me a chuckle, I have to admit, but on one hand, it sort of made me sad. Well, let me say hello to my next guest, Vajra. Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. I just unmuted you. I realized when I first started saying hello, I hadn't unmuted you yet. Silly me. Well, I want to thank you for returning to the show tonight, and I want to reintroduce you and your work to give an overview to listeners of what we're going to be discussing. Also, we'll get into your bio. Well, the topic tonight with Vajra is the fourth wave of feminism, embodied spirituality giving rise to more than a grassroots revolution, a womb roots evolution. Some are saying there is a fourth wave of feminism and call it a fusion of political and spiritual values. This is too safe and tries not to rock the boat. Vajra maintains that the spiritual story or religious myth of a culture determines its politics, its laws, social fabric, and institutions, that spirituality trumps politics, and most of all, that humanity's original spirituality is based in the female body. The fourth wave of feminism, according to Vajra Ma, is fully embodied spirituality giving rise to a newly restored societal fabric. It is our only hope. Vajra Ma maintains that fully embodied spirituality has the potential to forge global solidarity amongst women, to bridge ethnic divisions and divisions between so-called first and third worlds, to establish a bridge that not only includes but celebrates cultural, religious, and political diversity. And this is a bridge and solidarity we need in order to restore sanity and justice to the world. And here's Vajra Ma's quote. Over decades of teaching embodied spirituality, my experience has shown that direct bodily experience unifies women across racial, cultural, political, and sexual divisions. It does this without erasing or negating the diversity of perspectives. Well, Vajra, I can't wait to jump into this tonight, but you have such a body of work out there. Before we start getting into our chat, if you don't mind, I wanted to just share your bio. Is that okay?
Sure.
Well, Vajra, she teaches outside the codification of established traditions and doctrines. She's designed and facilitated women's rituals since 86 and has integrated goddess knowledge and feminist spirituality with experiential body wisdom, the conscious awareness of subtle body energies to forge women's mysteries of the ancient future sisterhood, a modern mystery school and priestess lineage based in the devotional moving meditation she originated called the Tantric Dance of Feminine Power. The Tantric Dance of Feminine Power evolved through decades of Vajra Maa's personal work from the innate power and wisdom of woman's body. It is the source work for many Tantric Dance of derivatives. She has developed demanding priestess training programs in her Woman's Mystery Priestess lineage. And aside from her own books, the workbook for the Tantric Dance of Feminine Power, a nourishing mainstay for students and potential teachers of the dance, and her newest book, From a Hidden Stream, The Natural Spiritual Authority of Women, Vajra Maa is featured in Daughters of the Goddess, an anthology of women's spiritual work in America, and her work has been the subject of scholarly papers presented at national conferences on religion. Finally, she has an extensive background in dance studies and theater arts. She holds a ministerial credential through the Temple of Diana out of Madison. She teaches with warmth, humor, and bedrock compassion, and she resides in sunny Valley, Oregon with her husband Wolfgang and their various dangerous pets. And her website is greatgoddess.org. So, Vajra, you are a woman who knows from where she speaks.
Well, yeah. The work that I've done is always based in direct knowledge, and that comes through the body. Within a context of devotion and reverence and surrender to divinity, to the heart, the deepest desires of the heart, and to the body as teacher.
Now, you're calling this the fourth wave of feminism, but there have been three other waves of feminism. Can you just sort of briefly bring those of us who weren't around for those waves, describe how they were different, and then how this, you know, fourth one comes up behind those?
Sure. I wasn't around for all of them either.
No, I know you weren't, but I know you must know about this. So.
Yeah, sure. And, of course, we're talking about America and Europe, basically, when we talk about these waves of feminism, because feminism and a reaction against patriarchy has been going on for centuries. So we won't go back that far, but in terms of modern history, in the 1800s, we had the suffragette movement, the fight for the vote. So that's basically the first wave of feminism. And the second wave was in the, you might say, it ushered in at the same time as the pill. It was the women's liberation, the women's lib movement in the 60s and the 70s. Very rich time where women started having their consciousness raising groups, getting together and bonding as women because we've been divided in patriarchy from other women. So there was that kind of a joining. And it was a very much politically oriented, getting women's rights, equal rights for equal, equal pay for equal work, etc. And then the third wave, more recently, has been the reaction of the younger women today in their 20s, 30s, where they're saying that, well, you know, I can wear stiletto heels and I can wear makeup and I can still be a feminist. So this kind of a punk girl kind of. Wave of feminism and a criticism of the second wave women who are now of my age, you know, in their 60s and 70s and so forth, that they don't really understand or they've divided, a criticism, and very much a criticism about how the woman of color has been left out or diversity in cultures and this sort of thing. That it's been very that the second wave of feminism. You know, with the women's lib was very ethnocentric, white upper middle class women, and so you know there's a critique of that, and I think an important one, very very valid, And so the fourth wave, well, is there a fourth wave? We don't know. Some people are saying there is. I hope there is. I'd like to say that it is what really inspired me to call the fourth wave embodied spirituality is my own experience of how important, well, the fact is I came to feminism, political feminism, through the body, through spirituality, through feminist spirituality, and always through the body. I came into dance experience. Direct movement, direct experience through the body. So that was what woke me up as a feminist. So the two are linked for me.
So do you think most people have trouble connecting feminism with spirituality, though?
I think it's beginning to happen. I think there's been a rumble, a wave underneath here for quite a while, since the 70s, since as Mary Mackey, who I just loved listening to. I've got to read those books, too, okay? Who she was inspired, you know, Mary Mackey was first inspired by When God Was a Woman by Merlin Stone in the 70s. So that has been growing kind of underneath and not totally, used to be dissed by some of the women in the political feminism, you know, women's lib, but now it's gaining more respect. It's gaining respect in the colleges with religious studies, women's religious studies, this sort of thing. So I think it is something that is... here's my take on it. Real feminism, you know, which is about, you know, being human, being everybody being cared for, living, as Mary said, you know, in connection with the earth, living a life that is sustainable, that is based on respect and sanity in how we use our resources or receive them and how we live on the earth, all of that and how we treat each other. All of that is based in spiritual values.
Right. So, well, you know, you see, to me it's an easy fit. I mean, I can understand maybe where some people would think, you know, feminism is just about equal pay or, you know, something, you know, the Women's Rights Amendment or something like that. But, you know, they do, to me, you know, they seem to go hand in hand. And, you know, I've never really studied it that much. I wondered where it broke down. I mean, I thought I might have read something about it started to break down maybe over abortion, that, you know, women who wanted the rights to do what they wanted with their bodies somehow maybe ran afoul of some of the women who were still, you know, feeling like that wasn't a right we should have. But I don't know if that's accurate. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think what we're getting to right now and what you're bringing up is what is the real core of patriarchy? What is the core of that drives that has created a civilization and institutions and ways of being in the world that is destroying our source, as Mary said, and as we all can clearly see, that is ravaging women and children, warmongering, etc., all of this. What's the core of it? The core is flesh is evil and spirit is good, and they're divided,
mm-hmm.
and they are. And that's the core of patriarchal religion, is that, or any kind of world negation religion, because you find it in the Eastern religions also. You find Buddhism can be very patriarchal. In India, where the mother goddess is still worshipped, they're very prudish, and you know they burn the brides, you know, to get the dowry, this sort of thing, things like that. So it can be very woman hating. The core is whether or not we revere the body, where we really embrace the body as a gift, as spiritual, as sacred. And that's why I believe that embodied spirituality is the only hope, because it goes right to the heart of this illusion of separation, of this demonization of the body, the demonization of woman, and then, of course, the deadness of the earth. It's just a chunk of rock, and we can use it any way we want. We can rape it.
Well, now, would you also say this ties into the idea that we've lost through patriarchy of our interconnection? I mean, is that sort of part of the body too? Because, you know, it seems to me it might be an aspect of the body, our interconnection in a sense. You know, maybe it's two aspects of looking at the body. You know, but it's like we're physically connected, you know, whether, you know, in like this huge matrix. And if you're truly going to be spiritual and you're truly going to be connected, you have to recognize this interconnection, but there's a disconnect when people don't care about women, don't care about other species, don't care about the poor, you know, because somehow they think they're not a part of it all, that we're separate.
Yes, that's exactly it. It's that separation, this illusion of separation. That is exactly it. It's the arrogance, or maybe it's the fear of acknowledging that we are interconnected and we cannot transcend, in the worst sense of the word, we cannot transcend and control everything around us. We can't. We are part of it. We must cooperate. We must interact. That's the beauty, that we're a part of a living organism, which is the entire cosmos, which is the Earth, which is our body. They're all connected, absolutely.
Okay. Now, you came to feminism in the late 60s, early 70s, and you were sort of rubbing shoulders with Shekinah Mountain Water, Marilyn Stone, Z Budapest. You know, was it different then? I mean, were they recognizing on any level what you're talking about now?
Oh, sure, sure. Actually, I came into feminism in the mid-80s, and I did work with Shekinah Mountain Water and Z Budapest, they were forerunners of me, though.
Sorry. I had my decade wrong. I apologize.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to honor Shekinah and Z, you know, as my foremothers. Yes, what I'm doing, because they acknowledged women's mysteries, the blood mysteries, the sacredness of women's blood and women's menstrual cycle, which, of course, was the original shamanism, the source of original shamanism, that it was connected to women's capacity to go into that altered state, and especially as a group, and go into the Moon Lodge, as the Native Americans call it, and receive wisdom for the people. And this, you know, woman working as a collective, with a collective wisdom, and that's part of women's mysteries. And then the birthing, of course, giving birth. So all of this was part of what was being taught by Z and the Shekinah Mountain Water and Merlin Stone, you know, that woman, that spirituality was inherent in women's experience, physical experience, blood cycle, giving birth, nurturing, breastfeeding, raising children, all of this. It's all spiritual.
Right, absolutely. Well, and no wonder there were, you know, goddesses of that aspect of a woman's life, you know, because, you know, there was a time when all of it, we didn't just take it so callously and cavalierly. It was, you know, sacred life passages, and, you know, there was sacredness in the everyday of those things that we just don't connect to as sacred today.
Right. I mean, you look at the seven sacraments of the Catholic Church, birth is not one of them, I do not believe. And Judy Chicago, back in the 70s, when she did her birth project, art project, she went to the library to research it, and there was nothing on birth as a sacred thing. Nothing. It was shocking. It's shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, think.
That is shocking to hear you say it, quite honestly. I've never thought about that, but to hear it validated, it is pretty shocking.
Yeah, and what could be more sacred and awe-inspiring and give you such a sense of wonder and beauty than birth, creation?
Okay. So you're talking about specifically embodied spirituality that is connected to the body, and when that's accomplished, then, you know, you feel like that will help us in the outer world, change the world, so to speak. you know, sometimes that's, you know, maybe hard for some of the listeners to grasp. Is there a way for you to, you know, maybe explain it more clearly to somebody who's never seen the tantric dance, who doesn't know, you know, how this can, you know, be connecting tissue among women who maybe have nothing in common?
Yeah. Let me break it into kind of two different sort of arenas. One would be embodied spirituality as Mary was talking, everything she was talking about in the cultures of old Europe in her novels and that Maria Gimbutas did the research on, was embodied spirituality. It was connection to the earth. So there was, in the sense of that embodiment, that you you saw the earth as a living being, her body, and your body was part of that and responds to it. And so there's that aspect of embodied spirituality, and also the drumming, chanting, dancing, singing. We have singing in a very truncated form in Christianity today, right, hymns, but nothing like the drums that unify people. Have you ever been to a drum circle? You know, you hear the drums, it unifies you. It's the heartbeat. It's the original.
Yeah, primal. I mean, it just takes you over.
Yeah, and it unifies you. And so from that place, you can feel your connection, is what we've been talking about, to feel your connection. So there's that aspect of embodied spirituality. And then there's the way that I work, which I think is a cutting edge of consciousness for humanity today, and that is our subtle body. It's coming back to, really, because the subtle body, which is a more very sensitive, nuanced awareness in the body. You know, there's the dense body, the muscles, and but then there's the subtler feelings of deep, the kind of feeling that, to give people a sense of what I mean by the subtle body, if you've looked at a sunset and you're just sort of, your heart opens and you just feel this beauty and you feel overcome by it, maybe tears well up in your eyes, or you've been at a birth and you've been just awestruck, you know, that the feelings that rush through your body are your subtle body.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
sometimes when the hair stands up on your arms or the back of your neck or something.
Right, right. Or when you get an exquisite touch of a lover when it's really gentle and you just feel this beautiful feeling go through your body. That's the subtle body. And so when I work with women, the Tantric Dance of Feminine Power is a subtle body practice. It's not external. It's not externally oriented. You are feeling what's called internal movement, the subtle movement, and you learn to cultivate that and become more and more sensitive because as the Indian cosmology, the East Indian of India, talks about in the Tantra, they talk about the 72,000 nadis, the energy channels through the body, 72,000 of them. And they talk about how refined that is and what a feeling of deep love, exquisite love, head spinning joy. And, you know, when I dance, I can get a spinning in my head of just like nectar. You know, it's ecstasy. It's beauty. It's feeling loved. It's like,
and now you feel like, you know, this goes back, you know, it's rooted in the very earliest times, right? Because, I mean, you mentioned in some of the information you sent me, you gave one example, like that documentary that was out recently, Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Within there, you know, there was a woman's body and a vulva, you know, and makes you think about all the Venus statues, you know, 35,000 years old. I mean, it took a lot of effort for people to make these things. It, you know, it wasn't like they had an electric drill or something and they could just, you know, carve it out in a second. I mean, these were labors of love.
Yes, yeah, and sometimes very dangerous. They would be climbing along ledges with just a little butter, a butter or an animal fat lamp, you know. This is like really, and that's how important it was to them to paint these images of reverence for the animals and for the female vulva. This deep sense of a connection, you know, that we just, we are so numbified to.
Right. Yeah, we've just again. Well, you know, we were talking to Mary about, you know, maybe the things we have forgotten, you know, the things we don't revere anymore, and you know, certainly a woman's vulva, you know, is one of those things when you think about you know, pornography and female genital mutilation and, you know, all the horrendous you know, sexual denigration that happens to women today.
It's astounding. It just makes you want to weep right now, really. The ignorance, the absolute brutal ignorance, brutality and ignorance of the beauty and the sacredness of the female body. It's mind-boggling. It really is. And so the embodied spirituality has a lot to do with feeling. Feeling your emotions, feeling a sense of wonder, letting that childlike sense of wonder that's natural to us. You know, we've forgotten it. We've contracted and closed down and dried up since we were children, so many of us. We need to go back to what is natural, which is to feel a sense of wonder of the sunlight and the smells and the temperatures and colors and textures. That's part of embodied spirituality, that sense of wonder, and being able to really receive beauty. You asked me earlier about what could it take for people to kind of get a sense of how embodied spirituality could change, you know, culture, could change the fabric of society or civilization. Just it's kind of like a two-edged thing or a two-pronged thing. What it would take to embrace the body and drop the demonization is huge. And you know, you're not going to embrace embodied spirituality. You're not even going to be interested in experiencing it. You're going to demonize it until you can begin to open the door to, well, maybe this is something that is not demonic. You know, because there are Christians who think, maybe Muslims too, I don't know, who think that if you meditate, you're opening your mind to the devil. I live next door to one. You know, and they really believe that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all you have to do is see the misogyny in Congress today, quite frankly. I mean, I don't know. And I don't want to digress, you know, but maybe this is part of it. I mean, I see misogyny when I see Republicans passing 900 bills that, you know, which include investigating women when they have a miscarriage. And to me, that's misogyny. That's not looking out for the life of a fetus. You know, there's this just lack of respect for women as life giver. You know, and I don't know, I guess I feel like it all just goes back to their arrogance, that they think they should be able to be in control of women's bodies. And it's nothing new, but I wonder, I mean, I don't know, have you ever thought about it that way, that, you know, that politics is misogynist?
Well, yes, and they do it in the name of protecting life, but they're not. I mean, that's what's so heinous about it, truly heinous.
And it's as if, you know, the fetus is their only concern. It's like the living, breathing mother is, what, is she just a body part or an incubator? You know, it's like there's no concern for the woman, and it makes you wonder if maybe somewhere in their primal brain, you know, they're still thinking in terms of the sin of Eve or something, that, well, you know, women deserve to suffer. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know what's in their mind, but the misogyny, I think, is rampant.
Well, I think you're touching into something that goes along with when I say, you know, spirituality trumps politics. Spirituality gives rise to the politics, and our culture in America and in Europe basically is predominantly Judeo-Christian. The institutions are based in that, and so the belief that, you know, the female needs to be controlled because sexuality is something that is dangerous and has been demonized, and needs to be under the control of the male, because you have the whole myth in Christianity of the male god giving birth to a male, who then he makes a woman out of the male he gave birth to. This is like complete reversal of reality. right?
Right, right. Well, kind of Republican-like. Denial of reality or the natural, you know, the natural way of things out there.
Right.
Sorry, Vajra, I can't resist. Forgive me.
Well, I'm totally with you. But that is really important because that permeates. That's permeating the thinking today in politics. It's permeating the making of the laws. You know, it's the male must dominate. He must control the female. The children belong to him, so her body belongs to him, and he's going to tell her what to do with it, and she's not in charge.
Right. Well, that's what you refer to. That's what you mean when you say the natural spiritual authority of women that's sort of been turned on its head. And you know, they you know, these institutions go about it. You know, they're slick. You know, they're slick in their spin and in their messaging. You know, like evangelical Christians talk about the new feminism, and they make it look like they're elevating women, where really they're keeping them subservient. I don't know if I told you, but, you know, I've been studying Kabbalah, and one of the reasons I was drawn to it was because they talk about the woman is actually more spiritually powerful than the man. However, I'm starting to wonder, you know, I'm at that dangerous place where I know a little bit, but I don't know the whole picture. And so, but it looks like me that even though they say that, in a way it might just be lip service because, you know, at the front of the room when they perform their community rituals, it's not the woman who performs the rituals, though they say she's spiritually superior, it's the men. So that, I almost wonder if it's not like evangelical Christianity where they talk about elevating the woman, but in practice and when you get down to the nuts and bolts, it's really the man calling the shots and running the show.
Well, yeah, very astute, and that just shows how permeating the whole mindset is that the male must control.
Well, and maybe that's why so many women are complicit in their own oppression, is because, you know, they're not critically thinking through this, and, you know, they're sort of buying the dogma rather than, you know, looking at how unnatural this really is, or how, you know, the deeds and the words really just don't reconcile.
Yeah, I agree. And the same thing was done with the blood, the sacred blood, the wound of Christ, the labial-shaped wound in his side when he was crucified, and his shedding of his blood. The whole idea of shedding blood to create life was taken from woman's natural function. That
right.
is a usurpation of, I mean, the whole thing is reversed.
Well, yeah, and I mean, isn't that a part of circumcision, too? I mean, it's almost like, you know, envy of the blood. You know, I believe I read that somewhere, that, you know, that's the male's, you know, envy of the woman's, you know, the power and mystery of the woman's menstrual cycle. So there was circumcision. So there was even tattooing and things like that. You know, it's like that's their blood sacrifice, in a sense, and a way to mimic, you know, to try to hold a candle to women's blood, women's sacred blood.
Yeah, and also to change the baby, the male baby, within a few days of its birth, to change its body from what the woman gave. It's really an affront to the natural body that woman birthed.
So the blood, Vajra, I'm wondering, I don't know if I've ever asked you this, but is it easier to make this tantric connection to, you know, to tap into this, you know, type of spirituality you're talking about? Is it easier for a woman when she's on her menses, or does it matter?
Yeah, it is. It is easier because if the woman will slow down and take some time to rest, which is natural if she can, if she's at work or hitting, you know, keeping a hard pace going, that can be difficult. But you can make certain internal adjustments and say, well, I'm going to try to attune with my body and be a little more gentle with it, even if you have to do your daily activities. But the natural thing is to sleep more, to dream more. You have a larger dreaming capacity. Your your psychic powers, your inner sense, your capacity to dream, your capacity to feel, your capacity to sense things intuitively is greater, and literally your outer senses are slightly dulled, just slightly. Don't specifically, but that's because you have the power to go in and really, women get itchy because if they're not going with that natural cycle of that yin cycle, okay, the yin, the resting, the rejuvenation, the place where we're deeply receptive and we can hear the inspiration, we can get the creative ideas, we're more creative. You know, hormonally there's things surging through our body that make us more creative when we're bleeding. So that is a natural time for a woman to connect with the wisdom of her body and also to connect with her sisters, like in a moon lodge. So I would suggest to women, if they, you know, the work that I do, I've worked with women with their wombs, direct experience with their wombs. And it takes a while to get that sensitivity developed because we're not used to feeling into the depth of our belly. And we can feel things more up in the heart and the shoulders and, of course, our hands and arms. So it takes time, and a really good time to do it is when a woman's in her cycle, when she's in her moon time. And allow those that fullness and that the whatever surging there, if you have cramps or something, they'll go away if you'll relax into it. And then let the meditate, let inspiration come up, because you're very creative. You have capacities of envisioning and intuiting things. It's all more acute at that time. So, is that answering your question? I forgot the question.
Yeah, no. You did answer the question, and I'm trying to vision. You say our solution to the world problems is a spiritual one. You know that you don't think we'll solve anything. You know that politics isn't the way. Spirituality is the way. How would what you're talking about here, you know, if we did have the, what you call this womb roots evolution, how can we begin to make that change? You know, I mean, how does this get disseminated in a sense? I don't know if I'm actually languaging it. Does it make sense what I'm trying to say? I mean, I don't feel like I'm doing a good job of languaging the question.
No, I totally get it. I mean, how would it really work? It sounds kind of far-fetched, I know.
I mean, you know, as a woman who knows about this sort of stuff, I don't think it's far-fetched. You know, I don't want to sound like I'm poo-pooing this. I'm not at all. I think this is very insightful and powerful and important. But I just think it might be hard to teach. And so anyway, tell me your vision. You're the expert on this.
Well, the common ground I think that we can all relate to is, and it goes directly to the body, to the female body, is that women, we all come from a woman. And I want to go back to the example I often use, and it's in my book, From a Hidden Stream, The Natural Spiritual Authority of Woman, how the women in Liberia, Lema Bowie, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize, how Lema Bowie, who started the Mass Action for Peace in Liberia during the Civil War, very, very brutal Civil War, brutal, child soldiers, etc., fresh heads on the stakes every morning in the marketplace. I mean, just really awful. The women united across religious division because they were mothers. The Muslim women and the Christian women united. They did it sort of hesitantly, thinking, am I betraying my religion? You know, is this going to be a good thing or a bad thing? But they did it because ultimately their motherhood, their love of their children, their natural spiritual authority, whether they called it that or not, which rose up and said, I am responsible for these children. I'm not going to allow this to continue. And they rose up as mothers and joined together. It took them they 3 years. And they also used shamanic techniques. They're basically shamanic. They chanted. They sang. They danced. As well as they did their tests with their signs. And this came through a dream. Okay, talk about the dream time. You know, the womb is a dream organ. And that's what I was saying earlier, when a woman's bleeding, she's very psychic and her dream capacity is greater and her inspiration, etc. Well, Lema Bowie, who was a Methodist, Christian, Methodist, African woman, she had a dream that said, gather the women together to chant and pray for peace. Chant and dance and pray for peace. She thought, well, how silly is that? You know, what's that going to do? The women liked the idea. And that's how the whole thing was born.
Ah, okay.
And they were very clear. And you've watched the documentary, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, which is about this this movement and their ultimate triumph, because they exiled Charles Taylor, the evil, the psychopathic dictator, was exiled. And then Ellen Sirleaf Johnson was the first female head of state there. They did it. I lost my train of thought.
But I'm thinking about what you're saying, I'm going back to the movie because I did watch it. They actually occupied an area, didn't they? All of the women together. It's making me think about the Occupy Wall Street happening now.
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's outside the box. It's outside the box politics. That's really important. Remember what I was going to say now is that the women were very, in Liberia, were very clear to say, you know, we did not make it political. We asked for peace. We appealed to him, you know, to Charles Taylor, for peace. We wanted peace negotiations when all the leaders of the areas to come together and negotiate for peace. And so they didn't make it political. They didn't criticize him. And I really think that this is a marvelous thing that's happening in Occupy Wall Street. It's outside the box.
Right.
You know, they tried lobbying and they've tried things for years. This is a whole new approach that has to do with our common humanity.
And I'm thinking about what's going on down there. I mean, you know, I get emails, you know, I'm bombarded with them every day in a good way, but they're down there doing spiral dances. They're down there with those dreaded bongo drums that the Republicans seem to be so afraid of, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, heaven forbid if they were ever in a drum circle, they might drop dead and die, you know, because they'd be so afraid of, you know what I'm saying? It's so foolish. It's like afraid of something so natural, you know, something that can be so moving and powerful. I don't know, it makes me think of that movie Footloose, you know, how the, you know, the kids can't dance and, you know, as Christian sects, you know, they can't play music and that whole thing. I think this is all connected, you know?
I do too. Yes, they're doing what the women in Liberia did. They're doing what people have done for millennia. It's natural, like you said. They're drumming, they're singing, they're dancing, because that creates a unity. And in terms of the women of Liberia, Lima Bowie, it kept them going. I don't think they could have done it. They couldn't have had the perseverance without that juice that comes from singing and dancing and drumming.
Well, you know what I'm also thinking about too, Vajra, it's been a long time since we've had them here in L.A. I mean, I think they still do them in Orange County, but you probably heard of the Dances of Universal Peace.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, I've been to some of those, and I have to tell you, you know, it's like a moving meditation, different songs, different movements. Everybody's doing it together. Again, it's this, you know, sort of embodied spirituality modality again. And it's almost like I'm waiting to turn on TV and see 1,000 people in, you know, Freedom Plaza doing the Universal Dances of Peace, you know, because it does. You know, I'm remembering how that affected everybody in the room, and I'm thinking about, you know, just how powerful it is. It does give you juice. It does make you, it makes you vibrate on a higher level, you know.
Yes.
I think
yes.
That's really important aspect of it as well, you know. It's taking you to a higher, better place where you can be the best that you can be, does that make sense?
It makes total sense. It's exactly what embodied spirituality does. It's exactly what dancing like that does, raises the frequency. I had a fantasy when I was watching the Occupy Wall Street, when the police maced the young girl's eyes. They had them behind an orange screen already, and then they just maced their eyes for no reason because they weren't doing anything. They were already contained. And I thought, what if everybody just started to say, ma, and chant together. Just chant. Just make a sound. A resonant sound. I mean,
yes.
What would the police do?
I love it, Vajra. That is priceless.
And, I mean, actually, I'd like to credit Ruth Gould Goodman, one of my teachers who said, she lives down in Venice, California, L.A., she said to have a march where people were acting chanting like a sonic choir, where there was this beautiful harmony and that unifies you instead of just, you know, chant, chop, 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 stuff like that, to just permeate the place with sound. It comes from the heart.
You know what? We have to get some of our women down to Occupy Wall Street and some of these places, getting, you know, making some of this happen. You know, I've never been to a rally with Starhawk, but I mean, you know, she's like the ultimate activist in the pagan community. I wonder if she's actually tried any of these techniques, or what she would think about them. Quite frankly, I hope somebody out there who's at one of these occupation hears us and maybe puts that to their General Assembly, because wouldn't that just be the coolest thing? Those police would stand there dumbfounded, and I'm thinking how much crazier it would make the Republicans and Fox News.
I think they'd love to ridicule that, wouldn't they?
Oh yeah, they'd probably say everybody was on drugs,
You know what?
But that feeds. I think that that feeds feeds the people's soul. And like you said, Vajra, in a way, this is even going beyond solidarity between women. I mean, this embodied spirituality you're talking about. Yes, it's important from the womb space, but I think there's a way for the women and men to even do it together, just complementing one another in a sense.
It's for everybody. Embodied spirituality is for everybody. And when just working with women, there's an extra power in the womb and the very deep, subtle work that I do with them. That's just for some people. Not everybody's going to want to do that. But the embodied spirituality can be this broad thing of the sounding, the drumming, the dancing that we share together as humanity. It's a human thing.
Right.
I was going to say, the chanting and the sounding, so it is like a drug because it does release drugs in your brain that would be highly illegal if they were put in a bottle. that's a scientific fact. And that's why it's so important to do this, because it alleviates addictions, okay? We, as a species, we need to have these chemicals moving through our body that give us a sense of peace, that give us a sense of unity, of security, of love, connection. That's natural. And it comes through embodied spirituality, through sounding and drumming and dancing.
Yeah, because when you think about it, the politics is all about divide and conquer. And through doing these natural sort of things, it strengthens the matrix. It sort of strengthens the human family. It strengthens the resolve. It strengthens the connectedness. You know, I am you and you are me, kind of a thing. And, what they do to you, they're doing to me. And so we're going to stand together and, fight the machine, so to speak. Well, Vajra, we probably have about our time has flown here. It's we've got probably maybe 10 more minutes, and I don't know if I've covered the important points of this, so I want to give you an opportunity, if I haven't asked the right questions, if there's anything you want to punctuate about this.
Well, I would like to kind of go back to the two arenas I was talking about, the arena of the embodied spirituality that we all share, that we can all share with the drumming, the dancing, the singing, chanting, and then the more internal embodied spirituality, the more nuanced and refined, which is what I work with women. I would really want to encourage women to sit and just commune with their own womb. Breathe into it. Feel it. Put your hands there. Acknowledge it. Even if you've had a hysterectomy, you're still built around the womb energetic. And to start to acknowledge it as a portal of knowledge, as a dream organ, as a place that knows how to create. I like to use the example of when people have had organ transplant. Somebody dies and somebody needs a new heart. So if they get their heart, that person sometimes will have things, experiences like, oh, I couldn't dance before. I really couldn't keep a good rhythm, but they got the heart of somebody who was a good dancer, who had a good sense of rhythm. They suddenly have a good sense of rhythm. Or they get somebody else's liver, and they have a craving now for beer that they never had before, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so every organ of the body has its own powers and knowledge. And then every individual organ of each individual person, you know, my liver and your liver have different qualities and they share. Think about that. The organ of the womb and the whole female, I'll tell you that the clitoris, which is an incredible, you know, it has much more nerve endings in it than the entire lingam does, the penis. So it's extremely sensitive and it's only for pleasure. You know, you don't pee out of it. You know,
right.
You don't get semen out of it. So it's for pleasure. And there's a reason that pleasure and the power to create are so unified in the female body and the male body, too. So there's, you know, there's a sacredness around that. I'd like women to really ponder that and feel that in their own body and acknowledge and feel it with respect and a sense of wonder. And if once you start really feeling the womb and you begin to, you know, it takes a while to like begin to actually have sensation and then let the body move from there. Let it move. Let the natural wave of the breath, everything moves in waves. Let the wave of the breath and the wave of pleasure, because, you know, in sexuality you arch and you curve and you undulate, that's natural. To undemonize it. And we have it at such levels in our consciousness, we don't even know that that we've internalized it. So if a woman will really start with that, breathing into her womb, maybe pulsing the vagina a little bit to get the feeling and sensation going there, get the blood there, the womb, the cervix, and the vagina, and acknowledge that, worship that with reverence, as this is the power of creation. This is sacred. You know, this is creation. This is how I came into being, was through this portal in my mother's womb. So that can go a long ways to de-demonizing and unshaming and unraveling the conditioning that we've had. And that's what I would like to say to women to do. And I'd like to say to men to begin to regard the women in your life with that awareness, with that respect, that acknowledgement. And see what that does.
Well, and I would also think it would be, you know, not just pleasurable, but it would be empowering as well. And as they're making this connection with the womb, are they not even creating new connections in the brain? Am I imagining that? I'm thinking, what's the term, synapses or something? You know, new connections or something?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's exactly what it does. And when you are connecting the lower body with the upper body, your sexuality is different. It's not just bump and grind. It's mixed with all of the feelings of the heart. It goes into the third eye. You know, the pineal gland in the center of the brain, which is the third eye, which is considered the eye of the womb. And there's a reason, you know, that there is a connection between the pineal gland and the womb, and the chemical information of the hormones, and the effect of light, and especially moonlight, that affects the pineal gland. So I experienced this directly in the Tantric Dance of Feminine Power. This whole stream, this inner stream from the womb to the heart to the third eye, they are totally connected and totally interacting. And there's a tremendous wave of pleasure. And the pleasure is the portal into the knowledge, into the sense of connection, and into the higher frequencies that we already talked about, you know, high frequency. And those high frequencies are purifying to the body and also open up the inner sense of spiritual vision and understanding, awareness, pure awareness and presence to reality, to the present moment. So that's what makes it an embodied spirituality practice. It's a total experience. But it's rooted, the work that I do is rooted in the womb, because that's where the power is. And you know, in India, The tantric teachings have always been that woman is the particular embodiment of the goddess, and the goddess is the great creatrix. The whole universe is a womb, and woman's body is built around the womb. That's profound. That is not just some functional thing where you pop a baby out.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a connection to the very source of everything.
Well, and I've long maintained, you know, that was, it was that power that patriarchy wanted to, take away from women. I mean, maybe that's oversimplistic, but, there it is, maybe it is just that simple.
And there's a fear that, you know, once you start, the institutions of patriarchy, they build upon each other and they entrench things and, and magnify things. And so we're in this place now where there's this morphic resonance and there's this structure, infrastructure built against the simplicity of reality, which is woman is the source.
Yeah, so the simple power, because it's simple, but yet it's powerful in its simplicity, in a sense. And I just keep thinking if there could be that solidarity among women, instead of women as the pawns of patriarchy, we could change the world. And I mean, and this is a tool that has come to you and through your inner wisdom and your work in the world, that can help, help women accomplish that.
Yeah. And women, we have it within us, our body is our teacher, the womb is the teacher, men's bodies are their own teachers, and their reverence for woman will open up portals within them. It disempowers no one, and it empowers everyone. And it links us to the whole fabric, to the earth, which is a great mother. It's a fundamental foundation of unity as humanity, as a family.
Absolutely. Well, Vajra, we've got about 3 minutes here. I want to make sure we give your website again. It's greatgoddess.org, greatgoddess.org. And so if they go there, they can get your books or contact you or, find out if you're given, because I know you're up in the northwestern part of the United States, but you give lectures around and about. Are you going to be doing any time soon?
Yeah, well, I'm going up to Portland, Oregon this weekend. I'm doing private sessions up there, and I'm inviting women to – I also teach in Seattle and down in Irvine at the Goddess Temple of Orange County, down in Orange County. Those are the usual places I'm teaching. And I invite women to gather a couple, three women together and have a small private circle and get introduced to the dance. And we can work really deeply that way. I like working in the small group, so if they produce it, and then provide the space, I can come and do that, especially here on the West Coast, but actually anywhere.
Okay, wonderful. Well, Vajra, I'm going to go to sleep tonight with the thought that before long we are going to be seeing tantric dance and spiral dances and ma chants and more bongo drums at all of these occupations. I wish the drum makers would send bongo drums.
Good. Let's get this part of the movement in gear.
Well, Vajra, thank you so much for being on the show. We're about ready to go off the air here, but I want to thank you for returning, and I want to thank you for the work you're doing in the world, and the wisdom you've been able to glean, to help women reconnect, and plug back into their own source of power.
Well, thank you, Karen. It's always a delight to be on your show and to listen to your show. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and tell Wolf hello for us.
I will.
All right, good night.
Good night.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking, the feminine consciousness, if you will, whether the great She be deity, archetype, and ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just will save the world. And listeners, I hope you've enjoyed my two guests. They've been wonderful, Mary Mackey and her wonderful books, and Vajrama with these ideas of how women can just plug into their own wombs and become the powerful goddesses that we were meant to be, so that we can change the world. We have it within us. So as I close the show tonight, I want to just read this prayer from the Goddess Temple of Orange County and leave you with these words, and please come back next Wednesday for our show. Great Queen, as the deep dark of the season of winter draws near, I feel within me the power to see all I need to see. All information, all wisdom, all knowing in the cosmos is at my very fingertips for my use in bringing more goodness to myself, to my realm, to my world. This is my power. I reclaim it. I know it. It is so. Thank you, and blessed be. And that's probably written by Ava Park down at the Goddess Temple in Orange County. So thanks to Mary Mackey. Thanks again to Vajra and her Womb Roots Evolution. I think she's got something there. I know she's got something there. And I just want to thank both women for being on the show tonight and bringing their wisdom to my listeners. So until next week, I want to say good night. Have a wonderful weekend. And go down to your local occupation and go out there, be part of it. Bring your kids, because you know what? This is what democracy looks like. Thank you very much, and good night.